7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Happy Sunday, Croc Nation. This is your friend, Dr. Tom Ianelli, the driver of your cancer survivorship bus. Next to me on my left, Angel Santana. Happy Sunday, Angel.
Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday. We won't tell everybody it's Thursday or Wednesday. It is Sunday. Angel, we have a very powerful session today. Would you agree?
No words.
Yeah, so no. That's a very good double entendre. So the reason why you're hearing my voice before actually hearing today's program is there's some explanation that is necessary. So about 7 years ago, I was asked to give a presentation to the Oncology Nursing Society, and I thought, everyone does a presentation, everyone does a PowerPoint. You know me, Angel, I like to be different. So I decided to make a short film. I have and have a relationship with the local community theater, and I asked them if they would donate some of their time, some of the actors, to come in and talk about some of the stories that I've either been personally involved with my patients, or have heard about through my patients, to try to put together a dramatization of some of these interactions. Angel, you did the narration of today's podcast. You heard these dramatizations. Let me hear your instinct, your gut, your feeling when you heard these.
There's only one word I can put to it: relatable, as a patient. And then to second that, really hits you right between the eyes and strikes your heart to the core. That's all I can say.
Yeah, I like to think that every podcast that we do is impactful, every podcast we do is inspiring, and every podcast we do is powerful. But I believe that this is particularly powerful. Going back to the beginning of my career, I always knew that cancer patients were special, and we've spent pretty much the majority of this year, our first year podcasting, trying to come up with different subjects that showed the specialness, quote unquote, not a word, we just make words up, of our cancer patients, of our survivors, of the unique situations that you guys face. And it was very clear that physicians use words that either can be soothing or they can be very cutting. And then when we started to interface with Dr. Len Berry, who brought Dr. Rena Audish on board, and we read her story of her own illness and the words that she heard while she was recovering, it really brought the subject back into the forefront of my mind, from the back doors and the back alleys of my, I would say, spider-webbed, encrusted mind, to the project that I did 7 years ago. So the reason why we're having these words before we listen to words is to try to set the table for you guys, to kind of give you a context of where this these vignettes come from. So without further ado, Angel, why don't you cue it up? And on the other side of the glass, we will have words, excerpts from a short film done 7 years ago.
We're going to start that, and we'll do it right now.
Words, excerpts from a short film by Thomas R. Ianelli. Who we are is not important. What we do is important. We take care of cancer patients. Cancer is not just a disease. It is a destroyer of lives. Just being good at what we do is not where our responsibility ends, it is where our responsibility begins. A responsibility that spills over to everything we do. Every therapy we deliver. Every patient we touch. Every word we utter. The pen is mightier than the sword, because the pen gives birth to words. How our words are shaped, how they are spoken, how they are delivered, can either be soothing and caressing, or can be sharper than our sharpest scalpel, more toxic than our strongest medication, more penetrating than our most powerful beam. Over our careers, we have collected countless stories from countless patients. We tend not to remember our successes, but rather our failures. Failures in our craft. Failures in ourselves. The following stories are true, dramatized by actors to honor the memory of these brave and heroic patients who not only had to endure the suffering and pain from their disease, toxicities from their treatments, but also the indignation and sting from our powerful words. Our first story is entitled Excess Baggage.
In my prime, I was a dancer. Let's be clear, I was a Broadway dancer, though I did dabble a little in commercials. I had the figure that all the girls wanted and all the boys wanted. But if you asked me what my most prized asset was, it was my breasts. I bought clothing that would accentuate them, and I loved the attention that they gave me. Not in a horrible way. But they became such a part of who I was as a person that to lose them would have been devastating. Fast forward to 82, not the year, my age. I was diagnosed with stage 1 breast cancer of all things. And I knew that losing them would be the worst possible thing. So I went into this going to conquer it, but not lose my most prized asset. I went to my first surgeon's appointment, ready to, you know, tell him I was just going to lose that cancer, get rid of it. He walks in, white coat, doesn't make eye contact, doesn't see me as a person, and says, double mastectomy. That's it, just double mastectomy. You're going to take away the piece of my identity that I hold most dear, and you're not going to ask me about it? To be fair, he then says, well, at 82, what the hell do you need breasts for? Because clearly at 82, you stop being a woman. You stop needing to feel attractive. You stop needing to have that self-worth. Then he turns and tries to make it better and says, well, it'll help you with your back pain. And it'll cure your cancer all at one shot. I kindly refused him and left. A few weeks later, I found a new surgeon. A young female surgeon who understood why I wanted to keep my breasts intact so badly. And she listened. I'm a lucky one, and I know that. I had a doctor who listened. I had a doctor who cared and a doctor who saw what I needed and gave it to me. I lived another 6 years. And at 88, I died peacefully in my sleep with all of my parts intact, including my most prized assets. And I couldn't have done it without a doctor who actually cared. So, there you go.
Our next story is called The Receptionist.
I'm 67 years old. I work in banking. I sit on the board of several local companies and charities. I run marathons. Other than occasional cold, I feel pretty good. I get a call from my family doctor who says My PSA is over 50. They explain that it's probably a lab error, but they refer me to a urologist at the best cancer hospital in the universe. They explain to me that I'm lucky to even get an appointment there. Lucky me. Apparently this doctor works with kings, senators, and Saudi princes or whatever. So I go to the appointment. I get there a half hour earlier. I'm greeted by this receptionist who can't be bothered with me. Initially, she tells me I don't even have an appointment. Then after a series of phone calls, she acknowledges, oh, yeah, I have you here in the books. After already embarrassing me in front of a waiting room full of strangers. So I wait 90 minutes in the waiting room. Another 30 minutes in this cold exam room with wearing nothing but a paper gown. Oh, and the doctor finally comes in. He's followed by 7 residents and interns and students. And without even calling me by name, he says, I see you have a really high PSA. You probably have cancer, but we want to do a biopsy to confirm. And then he leaves. Two weeks later, after waiting by the phone for an answer, I finally called him up. And to my great fortune, I get the same receptionist. I tell her, listen, it's been 2 weeks since his biopsy. I'm on pins and needles for the results. She puts me on hold for 15 minutes. She comes back on the phone. She says your biopsy was positive. The doctor says you have cancer, would like to schedule surgery ASAP. I hang up the phone. And I throw up. I spend my final 2 years of my life impotent. Sick and in pain.
Our next story is called Blackjack.
My story starts when I was 33. I was in the shower one day, pregnant with my third child. I had 2 children already, 1 in kindergarten, 1 a toddler. And my breasts felt different, felt hard, and I'm pregnant again, so I figure, you know, all sorts of strange things happen to your body when you're pregnant, so it's probably just a blocked milk duct or something, no big deal. So then time goes by and it changes. It starts getting hard and harder and red and painful, and then the skin starts to change and it doesn't feel like skin anymore. It feels more like an orange peel. So I realize this is not normal, this is not right, and so I go to my doctor. And he refers me to a breast oncologist. And remember now, I'm pregnant about halfway through my second trimester, and this oncologist thinks, okay, you're gonna get an abortion and we're gonna start treating you for cancer. Because the biopsy came back positive for cancer. And I'm thinking, I'm not aborting my baby. This is my baby. I can feel him growing inside of me already. You are not taking my baby. And of course, he can't wrap his head around that at all and pleads with me to change my mind, but I'm resolute. No, no, you're not taking my baby. And so I go through the pregnancy and I deliver the most beautiful baby boy I ever saw. And then 2 weeks later, my life changes. I'm not able to be a mother to my newborn baby because I now have to go into aggressive chemotherapy treatment, which of course makes me nauseous all the time and sick. I lose my hair. I'm not able to take care of my three children, and I just feel weak and awful and terrible every single day. And the only thing that gets me through is the desperate hope that this will save me so I can continue to be a mother to my three babies, who I can't even take care of right now. And it doesn't work. And so I have to have a double mastectomy. And I remember the plastic surgeon saying to me, "Don't worry, I'll make you new boobs." And I'm thinking, these aren't boobs. They're the place where my husband lays his head down at night when we're laying in bed to talk about our day and our children. They are what gave my babies life when they were so little and helpless. And I got to look down at them and think, what a miracle it was that I got to do that. These are not boobs. You can't give me new ones. And so I go to the doctors one day and I can't take it anymore, and I just break down to this doctor and the nurse, and I am desperately, desperately looking for some sort of support. And the nurse stands in the corner like I am the plague, with a look in her eyes that says, "Thank God I'm not you." And the doctor can't even take his eyes away from the computer screen. And when he finally does, what he says to me is, "You've been dealt a bad hand. The sooner you learn to deal with that hand, the better off you'll be. You just need to learn to deal with it." Four months later, my battle ended.
The next story is called The Vulture.
I thought I was done with all this. 10 years ago, I had a procedure that had my kidney resected, and they told me they got rid of the cancer. And when they did all the tests, they told me that my cancer had come back. In fact, it went to my brain. And they said it had 6 months. And they were shoving papers at me saying, "Oh, just sign this and be done with it." And I said, And I didn't even know what the word palliative care even meant. I had to be told what it meant. And I said, "Fuck that. I'm not ready to die. What are my options?" And they look at me like, "You have no options, man." So I basically tell them to go screw themselves. And I went and got a second opinion. And I was told that though I was going to die, it didn't have to be in 6 months. And I got four more years. Four more years to see my grandchildren grow up, and one even graduated from Yale, and I even got to see the birth of my first great-grandchild. And I got to see four more bumper crops of Jersey tomatoes. More importantly, I got to spend four more years of walking with my wife and having dinners and all those conversations that we would never have had had I listened to that original diagnosis.
And our final story, the Christmas tree.
I'm a 56-year-old radiation oncologist. I've been taking care of cancer patients for 30 years. There isn't a day that goes by that I don't learn a lesson from one of my patients. When I first came out of training, I thought I was a real hotshot. I was top in my class, chief resident, won every award that there was. I was the youngest department chairman in the entire hospital. I knew everything that was in the books. I just didn't know anything about my patients. In my first year of practice, Friday night, everyone's exhausted. A colleague of mine comes into the department with his wife, visibly upset, tears streaming down their faces, very distraught. He told me his wife was just diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer to her bone, and she had a spinal cord compression. I sprang into action. It's what I do. I told the staff to wait. I went upstairs. I reviewed the pathology, looked at the slides. I looked at her x-rays, and I came back down. I was ready to treat her, but she was not ready to be treated. She had questions. She had many questions, and I was exhausted. First, I tried to answer her questions as honestly and accurately as possible. I hid behind my medical jargon, my medical terminology. I acted like a doctor. She told me she was an artist. She told me that her brain worked differently than my brain. She told me that she couldn't understand the words I was saying. She wanted me to be more visible, more visual. She wanted me to draw her a diagram. I tried. Again, no success. I tried again and again and again. Finally, I blurted out, "Lady, your bone scan lit up like a goddamn Christmas tree. And if you don't let me treat you right now, you're going to become paralyzed." Complete silence. Complete silence. Utter silence. They were only broken by her sobs and his tears. I did treat her that night. We did take away her pain. And she did not become paralyzed. She died 3 months later. A couple months later, her husband came to my office, closed the door. I was so dense, I had no idea that I did anything wrong. He was visibly angry. His face was contorted. And I was in shock. He said that my words that night haunted his wife for the rest of her short life. He said she could not sleep through the night without nightmares. He said that her vision of my description of her body being filled with cancer and lighting up like a Christmas tree was really what killed her. He told me I was a great technician, but he said that unless I changed the way I viewed my patients and used my words to heal rather than to harm, that I would never be a true doctor. I thought a lot about this. As a matter of fact, I don't think there's a week that goes by now, 30 years later, that I don't think about her and my responsibility on how to treat my patients.
These stories are not meant to cast judgment on our character, but rather to make us aware of our fallibilities, our limitations, our imperfections. To help us recognize the power of our words and to be accountable to them. To reach out to each other and to remind us of our sacred duty to use our words to heal, not to harm. In memory of all those who have lost their battle, your bodies are gone, but your words live on to teach and inspire. My name is Angel Santana, and thank you for listening to the Croc Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's message, and we ask you to join us next week as we take a closer look of what made this episode so special.